Welcome to Innovation Alberta, a celebration of science, research, and the inventive spirit. I'm Cheryl Croucher. The University of Lethbridge is home to the Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neurosciences and leading-edge research on Parkinson's disease. Dr. Gerlinda Metz is one of those researchers, and with funding from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, she's studying the role of stress in Parkinson's. And Alberta Ingenuity and the Alberta Research Council have teamed up to support the work of Dr. Anthony Anya. He thinks he's found a way to make wheat more drought-resistant. And in forestry, one of the big challenges is turning research into practical applications for industry. George Broomer of Tembec talks about the efforts of the Sustainable Forest Management Network in the area of knowledge transfer. These stories coming up in the next half hour on Innovation Alberta. The highest incidence of Parkinson's disease occurs in Alberta, and the number of cases is expected to triple over the next two decades. With help from the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Dr. Gerlinda Metz is studying the role stress plays in the development of Parkinson's. A young scientist from Germany, Gerlinda came to the Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neurosciences in Lethbridge so she could work with one of the world's leading experts in the field, Dr. Ian Wishaw. And going into her lab, I quickly discovered that Gerlinda is also an inventor.
We are here in my lab in one of the behavioral testing rooms, and we have a set of different apparatus set up here for testing movement and locomotion.
What's this contraption here?
This is a ladder beam task, and animals are trained to cross this kind of horizontal ladder from one end to the other end. It has metal rungs inserted, and the rungs can be arranged in different patterns, so animals can sometimes, if they're in regular distances, they can learn to anticipate the position of a rung. When we arrange them in a different pattern, we abolish this anticipation, and they always have to adjust their gait to the rung position. And that's a test for skilled walking, actually. They're very skillful in adjusting their gait pattern to the pattern of the rungs. And when they are disturbed by something in their motor performance, then they make more mistakes crossing this device.
This ladder is actually quite special because you developed it yourself, didn't you?
Yeah, this is one of the features we have here at the Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neuroscience. We are very creative people and very innovative. So we develop a lot of different testing devices here because we need to optimize it and adapt it to our test purpose and experimental focus. So we never have the perfect test, so we always continue and develop and optimize tests. And this test has been developed over 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and it has been used for different purposes like spinal cord stroke, Parkinson's disease models, and people now all over the world started using this test, and I get letters per email saying that it actually works for them.
We retire to Gerlinda's office just down the hall at the Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neurosciences. While there's a lot of interest in Parkinson's research, she's the first to look at the role of stress.
At the moment I got my new lab started here, I started in January, and at the moment we are investigating actually the effects of stress, how stress affects the motor system and the motor system function, and if this project will lead into Parkinson's disease research pretty soon, within a month or so probably. We'll get started.
What is it with stress that you're going to be looking at? What happens in the brain?
Well, the system that has been widely studied was the hippocampus so far, and learning and memory. And it is known that acute and chronic stress affects how we learn and how we memorize things. If the body is exposed to stress over a long time period, then this affects the brain sooner or later, and neurons in the hippocampus that are involved in processing of memory, for instance, they can die under stressful conditions. And so nothing is known about the motor system, and from my previous little experiments I did, I know that stress affects the motor system as well. If it affects the normal function of the motor system, it probably affects the pathology of the motor system as well, and neurological conditions that concern the motor function, such as Parkinson's disease or stroke or other conditions as well.
How would you define stress? What kind of stress?
Well, stress is probably, it has a psychological side to it. It's how we perceive stress, what is stress for us, but it's also stress can be defined as a physiological condition. We have a stress response in our body that is a set of different hormones that are secreted during stress, and that can be a good measurement of how whether we suffer from stress or not. And these hormones, they can act on the brain. They act on many different systems in the body, and they act on the brain as well. And so they cause a certain condition on neurons, on the nerve cells, and they react to these hormones and to their environment, actually. And so it is actually a cascade of different responses that lead to the effects that stress can have on the brain.
In your lab, what experiments will you be doing? How will they be set up, and how will you be conducting them?
Well, a lot of our work is based on research in animal models for human neurological conditions. And so, for instance, if I study Parkinson's disease, we have projects that we conduct with Parkinson's patients if they are willing to collaborate with us on some simple behavioral studies. But we also use animal models to study some of these conditions, and we mimic some of the pathological conditions that we find in Parkinson's patients, and we reproduce them in the animals, and then we can study those situations in the animal model, and we can go more into detail than we could do on human subjects.
So what exactly would you be doing?
So, for instance, we would induce stress in animals, and then we have them performing a set of different movement paradigms, for instance, to study how stress affects their movement. And actually, they're very collaborative in these tests, and they really like it because they get a reward. For instance, they're trained to grasp and eat little food pellets that have banana flavor, and they like that very much. So they would do anything. It's like we would go for a piece of chocolate. And so we have them doing that, and then we video record how they reach for food pellets, and we analyze that on videotape in slow motion. And then we can go into a detailed analysis of those movements and study how they perform those movements. And then I can also study how stress changes these movements and the performance in detail.
What do you expect to find?
Well, our preliminary experiments showed that stress actually impairs the way they reach, and it impairs how precisely they can reach for little food pellets. The food pellets are very tiny, and they have to be very precise in order to grasp them. And their success rate in grasping these pellets drops down when they're under stress. They pay less attention and are less focused on this task, and they might not be able to get the same success rate as they've been able to get when they were not stressed. And we use paradigms that are closely comparable to situations we have in humans. We suffer from stress probably chronically every day with the lifestyle we have today. So this makes this research very relevant to our lifestyle. And I try in our animal models that we reproduce some of those conditions the way we suffer from them, actually.
How might this eventually translate into therapy or maybe even a cure for these patients?
Well, for instance, if we know which factors are involved in causing Parkinson's disease, as so far we are not sure, and none of these factors is really proven to cause Parkinson's disease, but there's a set of toxins that are most likely to be involved in the pathology of Parkinson's disease, for instance, pesticides. So this probably all acts together in a concert. There are different factors that come together, and there's an individual response to those environmental factors as well. So if we know about those, and in terms of stress, for instance, we can find a condition or a treatment that would reduce stress in patients with Parkinson's disease. Once they know that they have Parkinson's disease, they might be able to do something about the way they perceive stress or the way they handle stress. And there might be even a drug therapy available that can reduce the level of stress hormones in the body. So this is something for the far future. But with the environment, probably the stress level can be manipulated.
Thank you very much, Gerlinde.
It was my pleasure to talk to you.
That was Dr. Gerlinde Metz, an assistant professor at the University of Lethbridge and a researcher at the Canadian Centre for Behavioral Neurosciences. Her work on Parkinson's disease is supported by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research. When Alberta Ingenuity recently unveiled its Industrial Associateships program, one of the first six recipients was Dr. Anthony Anya. He's a plant scientist with the Alberta Research Council in Vegreville. Given our growing concern over water shortages and climate change, Anthony's research is very timely. He's investigating a discovery he made while working on a plant productivity project. His discovery could help wheat and other crops become drought resistant.
I'm working on a big project which we have termed here at the AROC as growth-promoting organisms for the improvement of wheat production. And this project is essentially about utilizing the known or recognized plant growth-promoting effects of some organisms to improve wheat production. So it essentially involves using rhizosphere bacteria to treat plants and hope that it will enhance their performance. These particular organisms that we are working with are known as nitrogen-fixing organisms in legumes. Legumes are usually associated with nitrogen-fixing organisms. These organisms live or form root nodules on these legumes, and in these nodules, they kind of form a mutually beneficial association with the plants. Yeah, they derive nutrients from the plants, and in turn, they fix atmospheric nitrogen, which the plants utilize as a source of nitrogen.
So this would be a substitute for having to depend on chemical fertilizers, is that the case?
Yes. Traditionally, if we grow legumes, we don't apply chemical fertilizers to them, especially the nitrogen fertilizer. So legumes now, we're talking about crops like alfalfa, peas, or trees like acacia. If we grow such crops, we don't usually apply nitrogen fertilizer to these crops. So what we are essentially trying to do here at the AROC is trying to extend this kind of possibility to grasses like wheat, barley, etc.
What are some of the things that you've found out while you've been working on this?
Actually, I started working on this sometime last year. My supervisor here at the AROC, Dr. Dan Archambault, initiated this project and got me to get involved in the project. And since I joined him here at the AROC, we have actually tested these organisms on the wheat crop. And we discovered from our initial experiments that treating the wheat plant with these organisms I'm talking about, we were able to increase yield of wheat by as much as 30%. And in terms of biomass, we got above 40% increase in biomass by treating wheat plants with these organisms. And also one thing we discovered again was that these organisms kind of stimulate root growth, and the plants that we are treated tend to have a denser root mass than untreated plants. Yeah.
So when you say that you treat them, does that mean that you have to plant these legumes in that first and then plant the wheat grasses afterwards? Or do you extract the organisms from the legumes and then use that to treat the grasses?
We isolate the organism from the legumes, and we isolate it, then grow it under our laboratory conditions before we use it to treat the grasses that we are working with, which is wheat in this case. So what essentially we do, we isolate this organism from the original host plant, grow it under our conditions, and use it to treat our wheat plants.
Now, the work that you're going to be doing with the help of the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, what does that deal with?
With the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, I will be looking at the effect of drought on wheat production, and I will be hoping to develop some organisms or product, bioproducts that should be able to mitigate the effects of the drought. And this all started from our discovery from the initial project, which is on the plant growth promoting organisms that we are working with. Our discovery that this organism causes roots to grow more, to proliferates root growth, led to our hypothesis that this organism can impact drought tolerance or drought adaptation on wheat plants. So with the Alberta Ingenuity Fund, I will be hoping to further test this hypothesis and see if we can improve the drought tolerance of wheat by these simple, inexpensive inoculants.
When it has more root production on it, does that mean that the roots can go deeper or they can find more water and that allows them to be more drought tolerant or not?
Yes. What it actually does is it proliferates the lateral roots. Thus, they grow more, which will definitely enable them to explore more soil area. They will be able to take up more water and nutrients. And in that case, a plant which has this kind of adaptation, maybe grows more root, will definitely be able to cope better when water becomes limiting than a plant which grows a shallow root structure. So that's what we are trying to look at.
How did you make this discovery?
Actually, I did my PhD on plant stresses, and I specialized mainly in drought. I have actually did some studies on drought tolerance of legumes. So when I came to the Alberta Research Council to commence my research work on the plant growth promoting organisms, and I looked at what this organism was doing to the plant, especially with the stimulation of the root growth, it occurred to me that this could be one aspect of, or one trait that is worth looking at, because one of the important traits for drought adaptation is root adaptation. And also looking at the plants, the wheat plants that we inoculated with this organism, I also noticed that they expressed delayed senescence. That means these plants didn't die off as quickly or didn't mature as quickly as the ones that we didn't treat. And delayed leaf senescence is another very, very important trait for drought tolerance. So when I looked at these two traits and we discussed it with my supervisor, Dr. Dan Archambault, we came to the conclusion that this could be something that can impact drought tolerance on the crops that we were working with. And we therefore decided that we were going to look at that aspect of the research.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Anthony Anya, a research scientist with the Alberta Research Council in Vegreville and a recipient of an industrial associateship funded by Alberta Ingenuity. When it comes to scientific research, there's a growing emphasis on partnerships with the corporate sector. We see this especially in forestry, where companies are looking for ways to reduce their ecological footprint without losing productivity. One of the challenges these partnerships must overcome is dealing with time. Research takes time, but industry wants answers now. That's where the Sustainable Forest Management Network comes in. George Broomer is the manager of research and development for Tembec, a forest company with operations in Quebec, Ontario, Manitoba, and British Columbia, as well as overseas. He's also chair of the Partners Committee for the Sustainable Forest Management Network. I spoke with him at a recent conference in Edmonton.
Well, in Ontario, the license areas that we have cover basically from Huntsville to Hearst, so from sort of central Ontario in the east to pretty much the whole northeastern part of the province. And so it spans basically between the Great Lakes St. Lawrence forest region, so tolerant hardwoods, white pine, red pine, right up into the clay belt, typical boreal type forest in the clay belt. So we're kind of in two forest regions, the majority in the boreal.
So you would be harvesting then for timber as opposed to pulp?
Both. We have a number of, I think it's seven sawmills now in which are the sort of the front end to produce lumber, and they supply then chips in turn to three, four pulp mills now, one of which is in Quebec.
The research projects themselves that you have set up in your area, what are they?
Well, the emphasis has been from the beginning has been in response to the so-called Lands for Life process in Ontario, which was a land use planning exercise to complete the protected areas network in the province. Along with that agreement was an agreement or a consensus on the need to look at ways of increasing forest productivity to mitigate anticipated shortages in wood flow, in wood supply. So the projects that we look at are all kind of focused on the wood supply side of it, and really the objective is to try and increase wood supply, but do it in a sustainable context from an ecological perspective and do it in an acceptable context from a social perspective.
Now, it sounds like, from your perspective, these are things that you need answers to right away, but with research, it always takes a little bit longer than that in order to figure out what's going on out there and then what to do with it. From a company perspective, what value is there for you to be involved with this?
Well, you're right that, I mean, we look for return on investment value for money in the shortest term that we can get it. And there are some things that we can do that are very applied in terms of research, very applied in terms of science application that do give us a return fairly quickly, and quickly being defined as somewhere in the order of 3 to 5 years. We're in year three now, and we expect to see very shortly some answers that will help us contribute to mitigating supply shortfalls. And then there are other things that you look at, and that's really where the network fits in, is that they're in a broader context, they're in longer term. They're more complex in the sense of focusing on ecological function and that kind of thing. So there's a blend of different types of projects that we involve ourselves in, some of which give us a very short-term kick in wood supply right away, and some of which will only contribute to knowledge in the longer term, which indirectly and directly will affect wood supply both now and later.
Do you see this as being an act of faith in a lot of ways from a corporate point of view? Because you must have to try and figure out what these guys are talking about and then take it back and sell it to the rest of your managers.
It is an act of faith. There's no doubt in my mind that if you involve yourself in an R&D program or a science program on the expectation that the money spent is going to generate something tangible in terms of commercial advantage or commercial application, right away that you're bound to be disappointed. So value for money really is demonstrated, I think, as much as anything else in I call it leverage that we can attract, both in terms of science partnerships with the provincial and the federal governments, with scientists within the network. These types of arrangements give us instant access to very credible scientists and a wide variety of disciplines. So there's leverage in that respect, and there's leverage for money as well. We put money on the table, but it leverages funding from the network, from other sources as well. So the trick is to get the right partners together and the right money together in order to deliver something that you need to have in the short, medium, and long term.
Certainly this is an evolutionary process in terms of getting information that hasn't been available before, but also in bringing together all of these things. And then one of the big issues here now at this conference is how do we take that knowledge and transfer it into the arena where it can actually be applied. From the partners or the corporate point of view, how are things moving along?
I think you've sort of hit on both the greatest strength of this network and at the same time probably the greatest challenge that it's facing right now, in that it is a marriage between the research, the academic or the pure research community, if you will, and the very focused commercial corporate community. And we're trying to find that balance in between maintaining and identifying and researching new things and then taking that research and applying it in an operational sense. And I think from an industrial partner perspective, we look at results in the sense of how does the research that's being generated here impact on operations on the ground? And it's very difficult to take some of the pure research topics and specific research topics and drive them all the way through the research to teaching the practitioner what the research actually means and then actually making it happen on the ground. And that's been, there have been growing pains and still are, continue to be growing pains within the network on how best to do that and how best to meet that challenge. And I think that's, we've actively been addressing that through the Partners Committee and the KEEP Committee, as we call it, over the past year and a half. And that's something we will continue to evolve, and that needs to be pushed really hard if this network is to be as effective as we all hope it will be.
Any thoughts on what your next step would be?
I don't think there's any sort of magic solutions here. Knowledge transfer has to take many forms, and publishing research results and so on is one form, and peer review and that kind of stuff. Bruce Matlock often calls knowledge transfer a body contact sport, and I think that's a very good way to put it. There has to be a lot of interaction forced interaction, if you want to call it that, between the researcher and the practitioner in order to make some of this stuff happen. And so it's a matter of facilitating relationships as much as anything else to make sure that the reward systems are very different between the two different communities, research and operational, and it's facilitating a relationship between the two that works for both.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was George Broomer, the Manager of Research and Development for TEMBEC and Chair of the Partners Committee for the Sustainable Forest Management Network. The network is hosted by the University of Alberta. That brings Innovation Alberta to a close for this week. The interviews you heard during this program are posted as audio files and as written transcripts on our website at innovationalberta.com. And you can keep up to date on technology and research events by subscribing to our weekly newsletter, Innovation Alberta Online. Innovation Alberta is sponsored by the Alberta Heritage Foundation for Medical Research, Alberta Ingenuity, the Alberta Research Council, the Sustainable Forest Management Network, the University of Lethbridge, Alberta Pacific Forest Industries, the Capital Region Innovation Centre, Alberta Conservation Association, the National Institute for Nanotechnology, Japan Canada Oil Sands Limited, True North Energy, ICOR, the Informatics Circle of Research Excellence, and the Health Sciences Association of Alberta. Innovation Alberta is mixed at Riverdale Recorders and is a Porcupine Stone production. I'm Cheryl Croucher.